newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Hundreds of festivals take place each year in Wisconsin. They showcase artists, musicians, communities, food, ethnicity and cultural traditions, and more. They're found in communities of all sizes, lasting from hours to days, weekends to weeks. But why so many festivals? What do they mean for our communities, the people who attend, the participants? In the studio to discuss the current state of festivals with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Gatto are Doug Kratt, president-elect of La Crosse Festivals, the parent organization for Oktoberfest, and Pat Stevens, president of La Crosse's Irish Fest, held in August.
Well, it was our ninth year for Irish Fest, and by far, any way you measure it, our most successful by far. It has really caught on, and when we got that going 9 years ago, I never would have thought it would have had a nine-year longevity. And here we are now planning for year number 10 and beyond, so it has gone very well for that. But I think with all festivals, the other night as I was walking into a chamber activity, I bumped heads with Jeff Thompson, the president of Gunderson Lutheran, and he indicated that we're probably getting he was at the Irish Fest and enjoyed it, and he said, you know, a lot of people don't realize how important festivals are to the quality of life in any particular region. And I thanked him for those comments. And he said when they're trying to recruit and retain people all the time, they look at the different activities that a community has to offer, and festivals are a big part of that.
And Doug?
You know, I would agree. I think that the state of the festivals, Oktoberfest going into their 53rd coming in this year, it's always changing and evolving. They're always looking at what they can do better year after year. I was fortunate enough to be down at Irish Fest this year, and I had the opportunity to be in their wee tent the last couple years and seeing things that they do and obviously the other festivals in the area. I think there's always challenges, as there is in any organization, but I think in general that they are fairly strong and that they give a huge amount back to the communities that they serve.
Oktoberfest, traditionally a nine-day festival, gets underway later next week. But next year, the festival itself will be shortened, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as we mosey on through this conversation here. But why do festivals? Why do them in the first place? Doug?
Well, I think Oktoberfest was set up to show what La Crosse area, the Coulee region, had to offer and to show goodwill. And I think that's what most of the festivals do. They're there for their ethnic background, but also, honestly, to celebrate what we have in this region. And the La Crosse region has just a beautiful area, and I think that it definitely gets to expo this area very well.
I would echo that as well. I think 20 years ago, there was probably Oktoberfest and Riverfest that were kind of the bookends mm-hmm. of the festival scene. Now I bet we could count when you throw in the Wiener Fest and the Growth of Apple Fest and all these other ones, there's probably 10 to 15 festivals in the area as well. And yet why they all compete for certain sponsorship dollars and other things like that, I think they all do bring a quality of life to the area.
Community awareness, pride, celebration.
All the above.
And more. Attendance. What are you seeing with attendance, though, these days? We have so many festivals. Pat, you just mentioned that sometimes the festivals have to compete for resources, but attendance is part of that, too.
Yeah, I can speak for Irish Fest this year, which was our best attendance ever. On the other hand, I know from looking at the demographics from Riverfest this year that despite five beautiful days, this was not their best year in terms of attendance or in terms of finances on there. So it's kind of hard to figure that when you had the dragon races and a major concert and some other things that should attract big numbers, I think it fell short of expectations on there. So they'll rethink that and come back with a new plan for next year.
And yet this year was better than last year.
Oh, indeed. I mean, yeah. There's no question about the last year was pretty bad. And I think you compete for resources within the families, too. You know, we went through a little bit of a recession there, and if you got to pick and choose some family activities, you're going to go to the ones that you like the most, whereas in the good times you might participate in multiple ones.
Mm-hmm. And Oktoberfest, I mean, it has a huge tradition, 50-plus years. Attendance has come and gone. It's spread out geographically, which also affects attendance. But what's happening there?
Correct. So I was just kind of perusing the numbers on the south side attendance that we've had in the last couple years. And we peaked at our 50th. We were up around 56,000 people that came through the south side on those. And those are rough numbers. But we typically hang between the 46 to 50,000 most of the time. So that's staying fairly steady from that aspect. But that's just on one set of our grounds. You know, we have the two grounds and then the economic impact that it has to the rest of the area. But, you know, with all these festivals, one of the big things that we've alluded to is weather. That's another thing that can play a big role in it. You mentioned Riverfest last year, and that was hot and dry, and I think a lot of people that took the toll on people locally and possibly people that would have traveled into the area. And I know with Oktoberfest, when we have rain on the grounds, it will hold back. Or if it's colder and rainier, that will hold people from coming back. So I think all of these take effect. So we try to look at more of a broad picture, you know, more of a long time going with an averaging on it.
So as you're looking next year at cutting back considerably in the number of days for Oktoberfest, what's that going to do to attendance?
Well, boy, it's going to be an opportunity, in all honesty. We're going back a little bit to our roots, so we're going to start on Thursday with the Torchlight Parade. Hopefully that will really bring a lot of our local population back out to really start kicking off Fest. And then, as you know, or people that are in the area know, that we get a very large influx of individuals that come in for the Maple Leaf, for the Tapping the Golden Keg on Friday and things like that. Maple Leaf on Saturday. So our attendance might be down a little bit more, but our big weekend is always first weekend. Friday, Saturday, Sunday on the Oktoberfest grounds are really where we see the vast majority of the people. It's where the vast majority of the tourists come into the area for this festival as well.
You mentioned, or you alluded to, the economic impact that these festivals and the attendance and what have you has on the community. I want to touch on that. Dave Clements of the La Crosse Area Convention and Visitors Bureau acknowledges that the impact to this local economy is significant when you add all of the festivals together over the course of the year. The impact of Oktoberfest alone, he says, surpasses $3 million annually. How does tourism, local business sales, and so on, how does that figure into how and why you approach your festivals the way you do? Pat?
Well, we know that you're going to attract a lot of people from out of the area.
What kind of attendance comes to Irish Fest?
About 9,000.
Okay.
Yeah, and heads in beds. You know, that's the if Dave was sitting here, that's what he would allude to right now. And he does a nice job of putting the dollars and cents together as to how you project your economic impact on any particular community. And I'm sure he's correct when he says that all of the area festivals combined put a lot of heads in beds. And then you get your offshoots on that, everything from gas stations to restaurants. The shopping center will tell you they have a good weekend when that goes on. As I mentioned, restaurants and so on do a great job during that period of time. And as Doug mentioned earlier, though, it's a great way for us to also showcase the beauty of the area. And so you get a lot of people that come here for the first time, enjoy their festival weekend. But by and large, just like a lot of our convention people do, they'll come back for another weekend or two and enjoy La Crosse in a little different venue.
So it's that awareness part of what the festivals create. And it's not just the sales or not just the economic impact at the festival itself, but it's truly the economic impact for the whole community that you too, Doug, with Oktoberfest looking at?
By all means. I mean, Pat's been in a lot of festivals, and Dave Clements can tell you the economic impact of Oktoberfest is probably much bigger for the La Crosse community than it is for Oktoberfest. You know, there's all the different kinds of numbers. The dollar that comes into the area gets turned over X amount of times before it leaves the area and things like that. You know, you talk with the people from the Restaurant Association and as the people at the hotels and the people at the taverns, that is, you know, opening weekend of Fest is one of their make or break weekends. We are going to be doing a study this year to start trying to get a better handle on what the economic impact is on the grounds for people that we're bringing in from outside the area, hopefully expanding that next year to see what we can get for economic impact on the businesses in the La Crosse area.
You've both referenced bringing dollars in from outside of the community with the tourists and the people that attend from elsewhere, but what about turning over the dollars in town with local people as well?
Oh, by all means. Obviously, we want the local individuals as well. But we also understand there's an impact on the infrastructure of La Crosse by bringing these number of people in. But the locals also are benefiting, obviously, because they are some of the business owners. They're some of the employees. They're getting all of these benefits as well. And I think that's a huge issue that is beneficial to the city of La Crosse.
Pat, I'm just wondering, so many of the festivals celebrate cultural heritage. We've got Norskadalen and Midsummer Festival, Westby's Set and Demai, and of course the two that you represent, La Crosse's Irish Fest and Oktoberfest. How does that affect the attendance? I mean, does Irish Fest attract primarily people with that Irish heritage, or
We wouldn't do as well if that was the case. I can assure you that there's a lot of people that like being Irish for that weekend, or they know a lot of the history of Ireland itself and would like to come and share that. I don't think I've ever missed an Oktoberfest, and I'm 100% Irish, and I think that's true with a lot of the other folks as well. They can come down, and Ireland is blessed with some great music history as well, and I think even if people don't understand the entire culture, they like Irish music, and people from all nationalities will come down and enjoy that.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Joining me in the studio for this conversation about festivals, their significance to our communities, and some of the nuts and bolts behind them are representatives from what are admittedly two of the larger local festivals. Doug Kratt is president-elect of La Crosse Festivals, the parent organization for Oktoberfest, and Pat Stevens is president of La Crosse's Irish Fest held in August. La Crosse's Oktoberfest, just a week away, is in some ways the culmination of this year's summer run of festivals across the region. They come in all shapes and sizes. We celebrate Warren's Cranberry Festival and La Crescent's Apple Fest and Holman's Corn Fest, Lanesboro's Rhubarb Fest. We celebrate trout during the Coon Creek Trout Festival. And there's Bangor's Firefly Fest, recognizing those fascinating critters that light up our backyards. Music is front and center, I think, Pat, as you mentioned, in many instances. La Crosse's Downtown Sound Music Festival, the Great River Folk Festival, Arcadia's Ashley for the Arts Festival. There are some very unique festivals. La Crosse has the annual Storytelling Festival, which is, I believe, the only such spoken word festival in Wisconsin. Can we have too many festivals in this region?
Not as far as I'm concerned.
Me either. I mean, they're each showing something different, but they're all showing what's good about this region. And so I can't see, you know, we talked about how there are so many resources and that we're quote-unquote competing for that. But we also overlap and work with each other for certain of these amount of festivals too. If you can show a new band, if you can show something about the heritage that people didn't know or a local restaurant and their food, I think that that's all. I don't think there's too many festivals because that might bring more people back to this area or people that didn't know that it was here and they lived here their whole lives.
Staycations having an impact on attendance? People closer to home keep coming?
That could very well be a case this year, I think, and maybe over the last couple of years during the recession. Again, talking to Dave Clements at the Convention Bureau and so on, they've put some resources into what a great place La Crosse is to just stay here and participate during the summer rather than spending dollars to go elsewhere. So I think we did benefit from that.
I want to talk a little bit more about finances, this time kind of the other end of that equation, funding the festivals themselves. Where does that come from? Is there enough support out there? We have so many festivals. Pat?
Well, there's three main sources that we use for all the festivals that I'm involved with. Certainly it starts with sponsorships, and those are individuals, those are companies, different corporations and so on in the area that are interested for their employees and for the community to add that quality of life that we were talking about to it. And so they were more than willing to sponsor. Then you have admissions, whether it's a paid admissions or a button is a second source of income as well. And then it's the actual products or that you sell are another source of income as well. And all of which, as Doug mentioned, are weather sensitive and attendance sensitive as well to get to your bottom line. So unless there's another source that I'm missing, those are the three main ones. You can throw some advertising revenue in there in some cases to help pay for some printing and stuff. But those are about the only three I can think of.
Right. We also put, you know, club memberships in, which are part of it as well. But I think the big three that you hit, sponsorship is key. Attendance, the buttons or the tickets are also there. Long and short of it is you got to put a good product on year after year. Give them an experience, and hopefully people will enjoy it and continue to come back.
How about rising costs? Are there increasing costs that you're seeing with Oktoberfest, for instance, this year? I mean, you all have had to make a difficult decision to, as you said, go back to your roots, but cut back by half the number of days that Oktoberfest. How are the costs impacting that decision-making, and overall, how to, you know, balance the budget with running a festival like that?
Well, as with any business, costs continue to go up. Obviously, you know, the bigger discussions the last couple of years is increased city fees. Coming to an agreement on how that can handle. Last year, it had a tendency to put the Maple Leaf Parade in very large jeopardy. this year, and last year we were able to make it happen. But, you know, the city's exploring permits to watch the parade, the Maple Leaf Parade. And so I think everybody, there's increased demand for those resources, financial resources as well, and you have to make decisions. Part of the decisions for the four-day, was that it? Yes, that was. But on the same point, we also looked at when was the biggest attendance? What were the things that were really working for us? What were things that weren't working for our festival? And could we do something different to put on a better experience? And we are hoping, and I feel that the four-day festival let us put on a better experience for the La Crosse area.
I know that earlier this year it was projected that Oktoberfest would be running a deficit this year probably. Things looking better at this stage of the game, do you know?
Yeah, we are, you know, because we've had to cut back on certain things. Mm-hmm. We have come up with a balanced budget at this point, but the proof's going to be how we do during our festival. If we have 40-degree weather and rain, it's going to put a pretty big damper on us. And on the same point, if we have 100-degree weather and it's really dry, that could also put a damper on us. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that we're going to have just the ideal conditions, and hopefully people will be out. They're going to fest responsibly and have a great time in the community.
One of the options that was put on the table earlier this year to help specifically, I think, with Oktoberfest was a proposal to allocate some room tax revenue to help support the festival in the future. Is that necessary? And more importantly, is that appropriate?
Well, you know, I know Pat and I have talked about this a little bit, and both of us were talking to the city about it. And the bigger question is, what are those funds allocated for? And but it does open up a little bit of Pandora's box of who can go after those funds and things like that. When you start looking at these festivals making significant economic impacts, but they're paying for increased police presence or increased street fees, that makes it very difficult, especially on something like the Maple Leaf Parade, where that parade can cost us in excess of $45,000 to put on. And that's not a money-making event for us by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, you don't need a button. You don't need anything except to be able to come out your front door or go down the street to enjoy everything that's there.
Or so reserve your space the 3 days in advance if
right.
you can.
Well, and the city's saying they're
that.
Not going to allow that
that's
this
right.
year, so I'm just want to get that word out because we've been told that. So that's all part of it. But I think that's a really key part of our festival is that parade is really, really neat. It brings a lot of people out. If you ever get the opportunity to walk in that parade when you come over the viaduct and you get to look downtown, it's probably one of the biggest rushes that you're going to experience. There's people lined up all the way down, and that's pretty neat.
Irish Fest and some of the other smaller festivals by comparison are more contained in specific areas. Do you have some of those same expense concerns or accessibility concerns? Or
I think one of the things we learned very early on is that to a certain degree, the La Crosse area is a little spoiled when it comes to what certain things cost. And when you go back to Riverfest history of a 50-cent button and then a dollar button and so on like that, to what it really costs now for everything from insurance to the canvas that you have to rent to the other things, it's all greatly increased. And you can't get by with $4 and $5 anymore from an admission standpoint. You go to any of the larger cities, you take on any festival in Madison or Milwaukee, it's $15, $20 a head to get in. So the Oktoberfest is a pretty good steal. Irish Fest at $9 is a pretty good bargain. I always tell somebody like Gaelic Storm, which is always one of our attractions, mm-hmm. They played on both nights of Irish Fest here in different locations at $30 a person to get in and watch just them. For $9, you got into La Crosse Irish Fest, and you could see 17 bands that we had over that period of time. So it really is a big adjustment for some people in our area. Not so much the tourists. They're used to that. But the people in our area really have to learn that it costs a little bit more to put on a quality activity.
I would wholeheartedly agree. You can buy these tickets in advance, which both of us, have been aware of and trying to let people know, mm-hmm. Or it's a little bit more at the time of the festival. But when you're looking at 8 or 10 or 9 or whatever for the amount of entertainment that is there, that's pretty incredible because I think it's been a little bit of time since I've gone downtown and listened to a band in one of the bars down there. But I have a tendency to believe that some of those cover charges are at $5 and $10 for that one night for that short period of time. And so, that's what we're doing. We try not to have any ticketed events. We do this year. We have a ticketed event this year with Brett Michaels coming back in. But that's because that's a little bit out of the ordinary for us, and that's to try to cover those expenses that would come along with that.
No state of the state assessment is complete without looking to the future. You've both referenced it a little bit, but let's return to where we started and ask each of you to look into your crystal balls and describe just what it is you see for community festivals in general in the future, and specifically the vision that you might have for your respective festivals. Pat?
Well, I am no stranger to Milwaukee's Summer Fest grounds. And I love it. I watched it develop as a very young boy down in Milwaukee from what really was the Jones Island garbage dump to the festival grounds that it is today, bringing millions of people to Milwaukee on a very state-of-the-art festival grounds that continues to be clean and improved and very modern and so on. And I certainly hope that as we look into the crystal ball, that we can develop a fest grounds here that can be used by multiple festivals on multiple weekends that have many of the built-in things that that we're paying for right now and have a good quality fest grounds that they can all enjoy.
And Doug?
So believe it or not, we have not talked before we came into this room. That's exactly what I would think my crystal ball would be saying, is that having more of a festival grounds, hopefully in the downtown district, to continue to bring people into the La Crosse area, again, the Coulee region, but the La Crosse area. I think that we'll see probably more synergistically working with these festivals together, where we may not have to duplicate all of our resources. I think that that would be a thing. I would expect, because of everything that it brings to this area, I would expect these festivals to continue. They may change. They may morph a little bit, but they'll be there. And I really hope for the economics of the La Crosse area that it stays viable for these festivals to continue to bring people into this area.
So I guess my final question would be then, both of you alluded to better grounds, different grounds, better grounds. What are the challenges of the existing fest grounds? You both, for your festivals, you obviously both use those.
Mm-hmm. So La Crosse Festivals leases those Southside Fest grounds, and we rent those out to various organizations to have their festivals on, as well as there's wedding parties and other things down there. So number one, it's a lease. And leases have a tendency to expire, or if that ground becomes valuable, it may not be economically feasible for us to continue to lease those grounds. Now, we have a good relationship right now with that, but that is one of the options that's out there. You also look at some of the things that we talked about at Summerfest. You know, it would be might possibly be very nice to have a outside amphitheater type of a location where people could come down and have a concert there versus putting in portable staging and lights and things. I was down in Chicago again. I know we're pie in the sky, but was really impressed with their outdoor amphitheater. I'm not saying La Crosse can duplicate that directly, but if you could see that Irish Fest could use that, or River Fest could use that, or I don't know, maybe some of the bands on a Sunday afternoon type of a situation during the summer. I think any of these things, the storytelling could be there. We could have potentially some nicer buildings that could be multi-purpose for being able to serve with some food vendors and things out of there, you know, have multiple uses for them, having more green space on them. I think it's nice to have the blacktop down because you can get your trucks in and out. But on the same point, sometimes it's not as aesthetically pleasing as you'd like.
But pie in the sky is what visions are made of, right?
Correct. Pie in the sky would be great.
And Pat, you're shaking your head. You're totally in support of this.
Oh, I would love to see a Summerfest type grounds here. Everybody keeps talking about the mobile oil site. You got 70 acres of it. About 20 of that is in the floodplain, which really can't support any other sort of structure that's there besides a park or fest ground. So it seems ideal that we could put some sort of combination use to that property and get to it. It's been 15 years now since they've been talking about this. So I'd like, before my days are over, would really like to be part of making that something special.
Pat Stevens is president of La Crosse's Irish Fest, and Doug Kratt is president-elect of La Crosse Festivals, the parent organization for Oktoberfest. They spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Gatto about the state of festivals. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk with someone who tries to inspire future generations to become leaders. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, pictures, and links to the festivals can be found on our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. You can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. What makes a good leader? That's one of the areas the Reverend Dr. Jamie Washington spoke about when he met with students in La Crosse and Winona last week. Washington is the founder of the Baltimore-based Washington Consulting Group and helps people with issues like diversity and leadership.
Passion is what makes a leader. I think that we often get caught up in the narrative that leaders are charismatic or leaders are the people who can speak the loudest, cheer the loudest, get the people, you know, to feel excited about things. And I would say that some of that is true. I think a leader is one, and whether you are leading a full crowd or hundreds of thousands, or whether you're simply leading your family, is one who shows up with passion and the ability to inspire others to move in the direction that they are going, that he or she is moving. And so that inspires people to move with what they are passionate about.
Does it matter the level of passion?
See, I don't think in terms of how you express that, so whether in your voice or whether in the language or the energy of your body language or whatever, but folks do need to feel such that they feel that this isn't just something that you are repeating or naming or talking about because you were told to do that or you're getting paid to do that or there's some expectation around that. If they feel that this is a part of your soul, this is a part of your gut, this is a part of why you get up and come, you know, so you could be like, whether it's about a product that you sell, about your selling, or a vision that you're trying to promote, a world that you're trying to create, an organization that you're trying to start, a cause that you're trying to fight for. It's about the passion that is behind it and under it that often creates the ability for a leader to move and then to move people. When I talk about leadership, it is whether I'm going to be in a formal leadership role to have people who are, if you will, under me, kind of follow and, you know, kind of become my next level of champions, or whether they are folks who are simply going to follow the vision that is that I'm talking about.
This week on UW La Crosse's campus, you gave a keynote presentation about preparing the next generation of leaders, younger people to step up to the occasion. So can you talk about sort of the state of leadership and maybe some of the things you talked about at
Sure.
that presentation?
Well, one of the things that I feel is important for as we prepare the next generation of leaders to get is that they understand that they matter. And where they are right now is an important preparation space. Much of what often young leaders see is old leaders, right, or older leaders. And they don't realize that all of us, most of us, started in their seats. And our passions and our interests and our agitations, you know, the things that we looked out in the world and saw, well, that's wrong, or we need to do that, or I could do that. You know, those are the things that kind of drove us into the spaces and the places that we are. So the first thing is to get them to see that right now, what you see as mattering matters. And it's not just what your parents or your teachers or your advisors or your coaches see that matter. Those are important things as well. But it is not just that, so that you help them to see that their world and their perspective matters today. We were talking about the 50th anniversary of the National March on Washington for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. And the young people who were actively involved in that process had passions as they looked out into the world and the visions for the world that they wanted to create. There were older people, some of which who were, you know, kind of really invested in this possibility, and some of which who said, leave well enough alone, right? And so the importance of them being able to see that there is leading that can happen both as young people, there is wisdom that they can gain from the older generation, but that they should not be listening to their own voices and the voices of those around them as they consider what we need as a community, what we need is, or as a school, what we need as an institution to move forward.
What are some of the sectors of our society that really need strong leadership at this point in time, and maybe young leaders?
Right. And so I think that as we begin to talk about the sectors, I would first say all of them need good, strong leaders who are coming behind those people who are already in some of those places. But education is without a doubt. We need folks who are passionate about teaching and about teaching so that the focus is on learning and preparing inspired leaders for the future and not just on the test, right? And I know that, you know, it really is important that we teach to the test, that students are graduating with the skills and competencies to do the writing and do the math and do the science and understand the social histories and so on and so forth. That is an important piece. But we also must be preparing students to be lifelong learners and those who have a love for education, a love for adaptation. And so education is one of those places that I feel is important. I think that there is really an important need for folks in terms of spiritual and religious community leadership. And that is not necessarily from any one particular faith-based space. But I think that as we navigate life and life's opportunities and challenges, folks are often in a place where they're trying to figure out the things that don't make any sense. And often a way of thinking about that, a belief system, a support place where they can go and navigate figuring out some of those things requires there to be good, committed, passionate people who are invested in those journeys. And we can go on. Healthcare, we can talk about medical, we can talk about the media and social media and how we, again, even just begin to interact because of the advances in technology, and those are wonderful things in lots of ways. As you look around, you'll find many people engaged in texting and social media and not engaged in human interaction. I've been in offices and been in classrooms where people are sitting next to each other, texting what they could say to each other, right? So it's not that they couldn't say it, you know, because, you know, the teacher wouldn't allow them to say it. They could talk to each other, and they're having text messages and, you know, texting your brother downstairs to come up and do something as opposed to going into his room next door to you or go downstairs and ask him. So I think there's all kinds of ways that we need leadership that understands the beauty and the value of technology, but also does not take away the importance of the human interaction and communication. So we need young leaders in that vein, because if we're just having the kind of my generation or the older folks kind of talk about that, it really does feel like you don't get it because you didn't come up with it. And it is true on many levels. We see a different kind of value in that because we grew up without it.
Right? And when you refer to leaders, are you talking about maybe a single person or a group of people that others can look up to for inspiration?
Absolutely. Like, I believe that all of us have the capacity within us to show up as leaders in our families, in our communities, in our organizations. And all of us may have the capacity to lead around different things. I talk all the time. I care about the environment, very much about the environment, but that's not what I lead around, right? And so I love to engage with leaders around the environment, and then they teach me and inspire me to be a better environmental responsible person. And so I talk with folks about leadership and inclusion and social justice and diversity. And everyone's not going to be a leader around that. And my hope is that not only am I helping folks to be better inclusive persons and better around social justice, but I'm also inspiring those people who will take my place. So I think that the other challenge and responsibility of leadership is to prepare the next generation of leaders in whatever it is that they do.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Reverend Dr. Jamie Washington. He's the president and founder of Washington Consulting Group, based in Baltimore. It's a multicultural organizational firm. He's visiting the area to talk about leadership and diversity. He's also the founder of the Social Justice Training Institute. Jamie, in your opinion, are there enough young people stepping up to become leaders today?
As we look around, in terms of positional and out front leaders, there's always more to be done. But I experienced that we've got some good stuff in our young people. And where we find what I often hear referred to as apathy and folks not showing up, I think that we just need to quiet ourselves a little bit and listen to what they're saying. Ask some more questions about what matters to them and what's important. And what do they see as they look out into the world to consider how they can show up as leaders in a more kind of visible and powerful and effective way. So I don't have there be not enough. I do have there be plenty of work to be done. But I've been very pleased and impressed with where lots of our next generation of leaders are coming.
How do you sell it to younger people, high school students, college students, this idea of leadership and the importance of stepping up and promoting their passions?
Sure. I generally start with sharing rather than telling. So I talk about how I got to where I am. I wasn't born in those things. I had a journey to those things. And all of those journeys started out right here. I was in the eighth grade too, surprisingly enough, and the ninth grade. I couldn't have gotten here without that experience. And when I was an eighth grade student, when I was a ninth grade student, I had the opportunity because a teacher said, you can do this, you know, and they encouraged me to play this song. And so my first opportunity, one of my early opportunities to be in front of people in a school audience was playing a song. Black and white. The ink is black. The page is white. And I remember the chords. There were D chords. D, D, G, G, D, G. I practiced and I got there and then people applauded me and I, you know, kind of moved from that space in junior high school and then into high school and had the kind of other opportunities and from there into college and began to share what I felt like in those spaces where I didn't feel like I knew what I was doing all the time and why were they asking me and to let them know that whether it's music, whether it's athletics, whether it is reading, writing, drawing, whatever it is that you are finding you have some skill and or some passion about, that it starts there and that you should be sharing that with others as well. The journey, not just the end of the story, and that's what I encourage mentors and senior leaders to be talking about when they're talking with young people, to share the journey, right? And not sharing it from a place of, this is what you have to have my journey, but begin to embrace your own journey. We all know that it's full of lots of joys, but also some pains and what we often refer to as mistakes or failures. And Thomas Edison and many other, just will, you know, talk about, you know, I didn't have 1,000 failures, right? What I had was 1,000 ways that it didn't work. I learned 1,000 ways that it didn't work. And so leaders sometimes, young people sometimes don't step up because they don't want to mess up. And we have created a culture that says, you know, spell check it. It's got to be perfect. You can't have anything wrong. And, you know, everything has got to be right every time. And so there's this culture of mistakes are bad and, you know, that you got to be perfect and you got to take this exam. You got to take this prep class. Everything has to be 100 all the time. And it does not create the space for learning and learning from the mistakes that you can make and doing your best and so on.
You talked before about the need for more educational leaders, healthcare leaders, environmental leaders. I can't help but think about political leaders.
Yes.
Is this something that you concentrate on? And do you think that more young people should be stepping up to become leaders politically, whether
sure.
locally or on the
right.
national scale?
Right. While I didn't name politics, Again, so some of the first places I enter are in those other areas. I absolutely do. And I run into young people all the time who have an eye to global and national, international and political issues. I think we are actually in a generation where that is being revived. I think that we had come through a space and a time where there was some energy around it didn't matter, there was a lack of trust in the political system, and, you know, why should I put my energy in investment? People don't trust politicians. There's a lot of work there. I see that very much also in religion, but that's another area where you have to be willing to be vulnerable, right? So that there is no way you can be a political figure and not be exposed, right? And there are things that you have to, you give up in that way. And I think that today our young people have seen a lot in terms of politics, far more than many of us had seen in my generation kind of growing up. And so, you know, you make one comment today or one mistake today, and it is gone within a nanosecond to the world. It's tweeted, and there it is in cyberspace. And so I think that there's a lot of pressure around that. And so the whole notion of politics and learning in politics and making mistakes in politics and, you know, feeling like it's a way that you can operate out of your passion takes some encouragement.
Regardless of age, do you think that there are good leaders within our society right now? And maybe do you want to mention some examples?
I do think they're good leaders. When I think about some of the good leaders, I don't necessarily automatically go to the national leaders or international leaders. I certainly respect and honor President Barack Obama and all that it means to lead this country and all of the folks who work with him on both sides of the House. You know, and so I am really one who knows that there's more than one way, right? And so I think that, again, as we named the political environments, those are tough areas to step into and to live your passion and to, you know, kind of walk in what you believe is your truth. So, but what I see often is some of those good leaders are those grandmothers that are in communities and those school teachers. I was with one today, a school teacher or counselor. I don't have what in me what her actual role was, but the first thing she wanted me to do was walk over and meet this group of young people and have them know that here's what you can be, right? So she's leading by example and by introducing folks. And so I don't think sometimes we see the encouragement that happens from the crossing guard or from the bus school bus driver or from the woman in the cafeteria who encourages the young people and the nurse and the school systems. So all of those folks, as well as the local and community leaders, are people who I see, and often they go nameless, right, that we don't necessarily consider them in the same way. So that's where I focus. And when I'm working with students, I'm quick to remind them that while we will have the national and international, you know, the mayors and the governors and those who are political leaders and highly acclaimed and visible religious leaders and, you know, entertainment leaders and athletes and all of those spaces and movie star leaders that get to do great things, those are the icons, right?
Is there a difference between icon and leader?
Yes. You know, as we think about that context, right, and so where we were in a particular space, our nation was in a particular space, our world was in a particular space in terms of, and so I would say we do have those, but we have so many, right? We have so much, and so again, as our population has grown, our issues are more complex. And so
there are more mediums,
more mediums too. And so I think you can go into any community, and you could be in the Hmong community, you could be in the Native American community, you could be in the African American community, you could be in the intersections of those communities, you could be in the LGBTQ community, you could be in the disability community, and you could get the leaders, the folks who have made the history, the ones who have stood on the backs and the shoulders and grown from and are part of the legacy of much of the JFKs and the Mahatma Gandhis and the Martin Luther Kings and the Sojourner Truths and those who led in the women's movement and so on and so forth. And so we've got folks who are, again, carrying on those legacies in, again, different kinds of ways and pockets. But because there's so much, we don't see it in the same way that we did when it's like we were a nation focused on race, right? We were a nation when we, you know, as we talk about the women's movement, where that was the energy and now came into place. And so we could have names like Gloria Steinem, and those were, we could have them in iconic ways, and they were leaders, you know. So I think today that there is so much of that in many ways. And there are some folks who are highly visible icons that might not necessarily see themselves as leaders and or not take on the responsibility, if you will, of leadership. But they are examples. And young people are always looking at what are those examples.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. My guest today is Reverend Dr. Jamie Washington. He's the president and founder of the Washington Consulting Group based in Baltimore. It's a multicultural organizational firm. He's also the founder of the Social Justice Training Institute. He's visiting the area to talk about leadership and diversity. And let's talk about that, the importance of having diversity within leadership positions.
Mm-hmm. Without question, today we are an ever-growing diverse community. And so whether that diversity is about age, whether that diversity is about nationality, whether that diversity is about sexual orientation and or gender identity, class, race, nationality, and so on, and everything else, perspective, political views, ideologies, the way we make sense, and so on and so forth. One of the things that I think that we as a country are navigating right now is how do we lead in a diverse society? How do we lead where, you know, you're sitting next to folks who have differing religious views and perspectives, and how do we honor and respect the right for all of that to be in the space? How do we navigate the spaces of diverse races and classes and genders and sexual orientations and create the skills within folks to be able to be not just diverse, but inclusive, right? So what we often are talking about as we go into organizations is it is one thing to have, you know, three of these and two of those and one of those and seven of those. And so now we got diversity. And so, yeah, now we're good. It's another thing to create an environment of inclusion where not only do we have all of this difference, but we engage within the difference. We see the value add of that difference, and we are also able to leverage the beauty of that diversity. How does, you know, sitting in class or having a group project with someone who is Hindu and Muslim and Christian and agnostic, how is that a value add to my degree, to my experience when I leave? You know, how am I a better supervisor because I knew not only how to, you know, kind of respect everybody, right, but I also knew how to engage my Muslim employees or my Hmong employees during the time of transition and loss, right? And so as a Christian, my tradition, my experience is, okay, we've lost someone in the community, and okay, so we traditionally will have a funeral at this hour and a wake at this hour, and then that's it. All right, and so I'm expecting that from other people. What do you mean you need a full day off? What do you mean you need a week to honor that transitioning of that person? If I'm not doing anything more than just seeing a different person and not engaging the culture, the experience, the worldview, the values of that, then I don't show up as effective at leading and engaging across the difference.
So in the end, you, others, inspire more people to step up and become leaders, and more people do own their passions. What does that do for our society overall?
It creates unlimited possibilities. We don't know the power. We don't know what can happen synergistically as we just are able to show up, feeling valued, feeling heard, having our perspectives included. Research supports all over that the diversity of perspectives coming together helps to give us better answers, better solutions, more comprehensive seeing of, you know, a problem and so on. And so I think that the value add for our communities, for our societies, for our world is just better. You know, we will be in a better place. We will be able to do more. We'll be able to see more. We'll be able to produce more.
Reverend Dr. Jamie Washington is the founder of the Washington Consulting Group, a Baltimore-based multicultural organization. He spoke about the issue of leadership with students in La Crosse and Winona last week. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews, photos, and a link to Jamie's website. And if you'd like to comment on our program, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.